Welcome to Gospel Tangents Podcast, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. In our next conversation, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Matt Harris. We'll talk about President McKay's consideration of lifting the ban as early as 1955. We'll also talk about an important first presidency statement leading up to that in 1949 that President McKay signed. This is going to be a very interesting conversation. I hope you check it out. I also want to remind everybody, we've got a special sale going on our website, gospeltangents.com. You can get a copy of Dr. Noel Bringhurst, Dr. Paul Reeve, or Dr. Darren Smith transcripts for just $6 each. Check it out. It's just on sale this week. Now back to our conversation.
All right, well, let's jump back into World War II again. Yeah, we took a side trip in the 19th century there. So tell us more. So I guess it was in the 40s or 50s when McKay went down to South Africa and overturned
the 52.
52. Yeah. So he was the new prophet in 1951.
He was just, yep.
And so kind of take us, you know, through the 50s decade there. What are some of the important events there?
Well, what's interesting is that, so President McKay, I mean, he learned about the ban before this. He'd been a missionary. I think Greg Prince talks about this in his excellent biography of President McKay. But this is the first time that this new church president is really confronting this very difficult issue of determining who has this black ancestry. And what happens is that President McKay gets back from South Africa in the spring of 1952. Or was it 53? It's one of the two.
I'm not sure.
52, 53. Yeah, I have to think about this for a moment. Anyway, so he gets back, and he commissions a report. He wants to look into the matter if this ban ought to continue. And he wants to know, in particular, is there scriptural justification for this ban? And this is interesting because President McKay, as a counselor to George Albert Smith, had signed that 1949 First Presidency Statement that you referenced a minute ago.
Right.
As a counselor.
Now let's talk about that 49 statement.
Yeah, we can. Yeah. And so as the church president, he signed that statement, and we can go into detail in a minute. But that statement makes it pretty clear that this is the doctrine of the church.
And he uses the word doctrine.
He uses
That's
the word.
That's an important word.
Right. And J. Reuben Clark writes this statement, and President McKay signs off on it. And George Albert Smith is feeble by this point, and he's going to die a couple of years later. But anyway, so President McKay, even though he signs that 49 statement, now he's the church president, and he feels the weight of this policy on his own. And so when he gets back from South Africa, he convenes a meeting or a committee of apostles to look into it. And it's chaired by an apostle named Adam S. Benyon. And Spencer W. Kimball is a junior apostle. He's on that committee as well. And interestingly enough, they reach out to probably one of Mormonism's most beloved leaders outside of church leadership, an institute teacher at the University of Utah named Lowell Benyon. And Brother Benyon had been very vocal in a nice way, in a non-activist way. He was a very gentle man, so I want to be clear about that. But anyway, he was very, very clear that he didn't think that the ban was justified in the scriptures. He was a very close friend with David O. McKay. In fact, outside of church leadership, he might have been in second only to Stephen L. Richards, President McKay's counselor. Lowell Benyon may have been one of President McKay's closest counselors or advisors.
Now, Lowell Benyon, Adam Benyon, is there a relationship
there? Yeah, I'm not sure what it is.
They're related somehow.
Yeah, they're cousins, I think.
Okay.
I should look that up. Anyway, so, not surprising, Elder Benyon reaches out to his relative, Lowell Benyon. And Lowell Benyon, I should say, by this point, has made it very clear in private, he's not a crusader, and he didn't crusade in his classroom at the University of Utah Institute, where he spent a bulk of his teaching career for the church education system. But people in his class knew that he didn't support the ban, but he, you know, left it at that. Anyway, but he made his views known to President McKay, so McKay knew about them. And so not surprising, when McKay comes back from South Africa, convenes this committee with Elders Benyon and Kimball. I'm not sure who else is on the committee, but I know it's those two. They asked Lowell Benyon to do some research for them, and he produces a position paper, and he just says there's no scriptural justification for any of this stuff. And so Elder Bennion writes his report to President McKay and tells him that there's no scriptural justification for the priesthood ban. And this is 1954, I should say. And so so President McKay contemplates lifting the ban, but he recognizes that it will cause hardship among the saints in the South. Keep in mind, this is still segregated America. So if he lifts this ban, it's going to create hardships among Latter-day Saints in the South. And also, too, there's some folks in the Quorum of the Twelve who wouldn't support the lifting of the ban. Joseph Fielding Smith would be one of them. And you know that he wasn't on that committee. So anyway, also, too, it's about the time that this report comes out that you may have heard that President McKay had a meeting with Sterling McMurrin, a philosopher at the University of Utah, a very liberal Latter-day Saint man. His grandfather was the presiding bishop of the church, and so he had some deep roots in Mormon history. Anyway, he was always loyal to the church, McMurrin, in the sense that he wanted to defend it when he thought it needed to be defended, but he was very critical about the black issue. And he asked President McKay about the ban just as this Bennion committee was formalizing its report. And after they formed their report, and Lowell Bennion had suggested that there was no scriptural justification for it, Elder Bennion passed that along to President McKay. And President McKay told Sterling McMurrin, this non-practicing Latter-day Saint at the University of Utah, he said that the ban was not rooted in doctrine, but was a policy. And that's been out there for a little bit, that right. statement. And actually, this is 54 when that statement comes out. It's not until 68 when it becomes known. So anyway.
So this is just 5 years after that first presidency statement.
That's
though.
Correct.
So we go from a doctrine in 49 to a policy in 54.
That's correct. And yes, that's absolutely correct. And so obviously there are some differences of views about these kinds of things, because Joseph Fielding Smith and Elder Peterson, Marquis Peterson, they think that it's rooted in scripture, it's rooted in doctrine. And President McKay is saying, no, it's policy. And that if it's policy, of course, it means it can be changed. And so, and then just to finish the thought here, President McKay will invite a Canadian man named Hubie Brown into the first, well, they call him as an apostle first. He's an assistant to the Quorum of the Twelve.
Which would probably be a 70 today.
And then, I think it's 1953, he's called into the Quorum. And then it's 1958, he's elevated to the first presidency. But anyway, Hubie Brown had long been an opponent of the priesthood ban and didn't think there was any scriptural justification for it. So now you've got this Bennion report, you've got this very charismatic, influential new apostle, Hubie Brown, and then you've got President McKay. And then you've got some of the other folks in the Quorum who are very, I guess we would call them doctrinal hardliners. I mean, this is what the scriptures say, and if you know anything about Joseph Fielding Smith, you know that he was a hardliner.
Well, he wrote a book that addressed the priesthood ban that I think we wouldn't be too proud of right now. Is that true?
Yeah, he wrote a book in 1931, and it's a tough book. It's probably the most important book. I talk about this in my next book a lot, how influential that Joseph Fielding Smith was. He was called into the Quorum of the Twelve in 1910 when he was in his early 30s. And, you know, his father was a significant figure. His brother, I think, was in the Quorum of the Twelve. So he's got some deep stock in the church leadership. And, of course, knowing who is Joseph Smith and Hiram Smith, mm-hmm. you know, what they are to Joseph Fielding. Anyway, so he writes a book in 1931, and he outlines in the three chapters his views about the ban, and he ties it back to Joseph Smith, and he of course talks about the Old Testament scriptures of the curse and Cain and Ham and all of that. And it's that book that really, really defines the tone for church leadership by the mid part of the 20th century. Because when Latter-day Saints and even people not of the faith are writing into the First Presidency asking them about the ban, the general authorities are sending back chapters 15 and 16 of Joseph Fielding Smith's book. And they'll say, read these chapters, it explains everything. And so it becomes the go-to guide. And it goes through several reprint editions. It first comes out in 1931, and I don't think it's removed from print until 1984.
Wow, 50 years.
And the book is, it's controversial because of the curse and all that stuff. And
now, what was the name of the book?
Let's see, what was the name of the book? The, you would ask me, put me on the spot. It'll come to me
it's
in 3 minutes and I'll blurt it out.
I'm trying to remember, is it something about perfection or it could
be... Yeah, it's got perfection of the title. Tempted to look it up on my phone. Yeah, it's funny how I remember the date it was published in 1931. I can't remember the title of the book. My kids will joke that I know the plot line of the movie, but I can't remember the movie. But anyway, so it's this book that comes out in 1931. And what's interesting about this book is I'm told by a BYU professor who's done a lot of research in Brazil. Mark Grover is his name, really a wonderful man. And Mark told me that that when they published Joseph Fielding Smith's book in Brazil, they left out chapters 15 and 16.
Really?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Because it's kind of tough stuff.
Yeah.
So in this same book is one of the books that influences his son-in-law when he writes his classic book, Mormon Doctrine.
Which would be Bruce R. McConkie.
Which would be Bruce R. McConkie, yeah. So anyway, that's what's going on in the 50s. Also, I should say a word that it's really interesting. There's a lot of people going, there's a lot of students in the church education system and also at BYU, or this is the 50s. So the civil rights movement hasn't quite taken off yet, at least as we know it today from the 60s. We see a groundswell of racial equality that will emerge, you know, from the Brown versus the Board decision in 1954, and then you get the murder of Emmett Till and Rosa Parks. But the church leaders will start to talk about it in earnest. And what do we do about the Brown decision where we desegregate schools? And the church is, they're worried about this because if you break down desegregation and you allow blacks and whites to go to school together, to work together, then of course that creates a familiarity and intimacy. And ultimately they'll start to be friends, they'll start to date, and then eventually marry. And that's really what they're worried about. And this is why they're opposed to the Brown decision. Most of the leaders are opposed to the Brown versus the Board decision. This is why they're opposed initially to civil rights. Because if you break down those racial barriers, it'll lead to miscegenation. And they don't think that that's what God wants. And you do start to see these things percolating up. And but back to I'm getting ahead of myself, at BYU and some of these CES students, they start to write to church leaders asking, these are college students now, why are we denying black people these privileges? There are BYU faculty who create this underground, if you will, and some of whom are on the religious education, in the religious education department, and they're starting to question the ban. And not publicly, but privately. And they're scratching their heads thinking that, I don't see this in the scriptures, you know, what's going on? And one young woman writes, this is 1952, she writes a letter to President McKay, and she says, can you tell me why we can't give black people the priesthood? Help me out with my research. I'm going to do a research paper for my English class. And President McKay writes Ernest Wilkinson a letter. Xerox is the letter from a student, so he had background knowledge. He said, would you please reach out to her and tell her that we're not interested in researching things of this nature?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So Ernest Wilkinson, the BYU president, broke the news to this young woman from Orem, Utah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's 1952. So you see this a lot in the 50s. And it's questioning, it's forcing the brethren to really think about, you know, what their views are, and especially as there are national current trends going on with civil rights. And it puts the church in a really tough position because the winds are blowing one way and the church is standing firm, thinking that they have inherited this doctrine from the prophet Joseph Smith that they ought not to give black people the priesthood and temple privileges. So,
very interesting.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Matt Harris. In our next conversation, we'll talk about Hubie Brown's attempts to end the ban as early as 1962.
In March of 1962, Hubie Brown tells Lowell Bunyan, he says, we're going to lift the ban here next month. Make sure you come to conference.
62?
This is March of 62.
Wow.
Come to conference next month. We're going to lift the ban. So the prediction, of course, is in April of 62, we're going to have this big announcement at General Conference. We have been studying this issue, and there is nothing that is more difficult for the church, Brown tells Bunyan, than this issue, and we're going to fix it. And so I can only imagine Bunyan showing up and nothing happens.
Thank you so much for listening. Make sure that you like our page on facebook.com/gospeltangents. You can subscribe at YouTube at youtube.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at @gospeltangents, as well as make sure that you subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss any of our episodes. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our videos. Thanks again.